Join Ligonier Ministries in early August 2017 as we celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. Ligonier Teaching Fellows Drs. Robert Godfrey and Stephen Nichols will lead us on a Martin Luther and Elbe River Reformation study tour and cruise. We will make stops in Melnick, Little Maurice, Saxon, Dresden, Meissen, Wittenberg, and Dessau while studying Luther's impact on the Reformation. Pre-tour options include teaching and sightseeing for 3 days in Prague. Our post-cruise tour includes stops in Eisleben, Erfurt, and Eisenach, allowing for further study on Luther's life. Call Sovereign Cruises at 877-661-6458, extension 100. That's 877-661-6458, extension 100. Or visit the event tab at ligonier.org for more information. Space fills quickly, so call now to reserve your spot. On the Tuesday edition of Renewing Your Mind.
The primary purpose by which government was created in the first place was to exercise restraint upon human evil, to preserve the very possibility of human existence.
Dr. R.C. Sproul from his series, Church and State, next. One week from today, millions of Americans will make their way to voting precincts around the country to decide who our next president will be. Dr. R.C. Sproul will be the first to tell you that Ligonier Ministries does not exist to advise you on how to cast your ballot. We are a teaching ministry. But since the Bible has much to say about how we as Christians should interact with civil government, R.C. developed a teaching series called Church and State. Dr. Sproul begins this series with a lesson titled, Legal Force.
In the next few programs, we're going to take a look at one of the most important issues that faces the Christian in our day, and that is the question of the relationship between the church and the state. Now, what we'll be looking at is not so much the nature of the church, but rather the nature of the state and how the church is called to relate to it. And this has been a matter of great concern to the Christian community from the very beginning of the Christian faith, because when we look at the Old Testament situation, we realize that in Old Testament Israel, you had what was virtually a theocracy, a state which was ruled by God through the anointed kings, and that the church and state, though they had certain distinctions between the work of the priests and the work of the kings, which still represented some difference between church and state, then nevertheless were so closely integrated one with another that to speak of separation of the two would be a misnomer. But once the New Testament community was established and the church was a missionary church moving out to all kinds of different nations and tribes and people who were ruled over by secular governments, the church had to face the question of how do we as Christians relate to the Roman Empire, for example, or to the local magistrate in Corinth or in Ephesus in Asia Minor or wherever the church spread. And so for centuries, the church has had to come to a careful examination of its role vis-a-vis the organized government in which it finds itself. Now, let's begin our study of this by asking the most basic, fundamental questions. The first question is, what is government in its most elementary foundational form? We realize that there are all different types of government, all different structures of government, and we're going to look at a few of those in the next few days. But now we're asking the most basal question of all, what is, in the foundational sense, the essence of human government? And I'm going to answer that question for us in one word. It is the word force. Government is force. But it's not just any kind of force. An atomic bomb going off is an example of force. But what we're talking about here is a kind of force that is backed by some kind of legal structure. So we're not satisfied simply to say force, but to say legal force. Government is a structure that is endowed legally with the right to use force to compel its citizens to do certain things and not do other things. I remember an opportunity I had to have lunch with a somewhat well-known senator of the United States. This was almost 20 years ago, and we were having lunch in the Senate dining room in Washington. And at that time, we were discussing some of the issues involved with the Vietnamese War. And this senator said to me over lunch, he said, "I don't believe that any government ever has the right to force its citizens to do what they don't want to do." And I almost choked to death on my soup. And I said to him, "Senator," I said, "what I hear you saying is that no government has the right to govern. Because if you take legal force away from government, all you have left for government to do is to make suggestions as to how people behave. But when governments enact laws, always with the enactment of those laws, the government functions as that which is designed to enforce whatever laws are enacted. And in that respect, government becomes the legal manifestation of such force, because their task is to enforce the laws that are passed. Now, originally, we have to ask the next question: where does government come from? And originally, the original form of government is rested in the rule and authority of God Himself. God is the author of the universe, and with that authorship of the universe comes the authority over that which He has made. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. And so before there was any human government ever established, there already was government at the very moment of creation. Because in creation, the creation of human beings, the author of the universe, who governs the universe, also gave commands to His first creatures, to Adam and Eve. And with those commands, prohibitions, and with the commands, certain sanctions that would be exercised if the reign or the rule of God would be disobeyed. And God gave the threat and the ominous warning attached to the law: the day that you shall eat of it, you shall surely die. That is, penal sanctions would be imposed by His authority. Well, we know that when they did disobey His government and rebelled against His authority, though that day they suffered spiritual death, they did not undergo physical death immediately. Although that curse was not removed from them, it was merely postponed. God, in His graciousness, exercised mercy, a kind of executive clemency, insofar as He allowed His guilty creatures to continue to live. But one of the punishments that He imposed upon this rebellious creature was to banish Adam and Eve from Eden. That they had to go live east of Eden. Now, the first manifestation that we find biblically of earthly government may be seen in the angel that God places at the entrance to the Garden of Eden. Because that angel stands there at the gateway to Eden with a flaming sword. That is, he is given an instrument of power, an instrument of force in the flaming sword to prevent Adam and Eve from returning to the paradise in which they were created. So this is the first example of delegated authority or government over the world that is given to the angel. However, there was still an authority structure of a different sort, as it were, manifest even before the fall, where God delegates to Adam and Eve dominion over the earth, so that they are to exercise authority over the animals. It's not authority over people, but it is authority over the earth and the environs and the creatures therein, over all of the lesser forms of divine creation. But the first manifestation that we see of government of people comes with the angel with the flaming sword. Now, St. Augustine, early on in Christian church history, made the observation that government is a necessary evil. That in this world, among fallen human creatures, you will never find a morally perfect government. All governments, no matter what structure they manifest, are representative of fallen humanity, because governments are made up of people. And people are fallen, and exercising government does not involve an exemption from that human corruption. I don't think I'd need to labor the point that human government can be corrupt. I think we're all pretty much aware of that in this day and age. But what Augustine was getting at was this. He said that governments and government itself is evil, but it's a necessary evil. And the reason it's a necessary evil is because it is necessary because of evil. Augustine argued that human government was not necessary prior to the fall. Now, Aquinas differed with him a little bit on that point, saying that, well, he could still see a role for government in managing the division of labor that you could have even in an unfallen creation, though Aquinas certainly agreed that the primary purpose of government was to restrain evil. Let me say it again. The primary purpose by which government was created in the first place was to exercise restraint upon human evil, to preserve the very possibility of human existence, so that the first task of government in the preservation of the human race by guarding people against the danger of evil was to protect, to support, and to maintain human life. That's the ultimate raison d'etre for the existence of government in the first place, to protect human life from the destructive impulses of other human beings. Now, added to that was also the protection of human property from those who would violate other human beings by stealing, abusing, destroying, or whatever, bringing violence and injury to other human beings' property, and also to regulate agreements and uphold contracts and to ensure just weights and balances and so on. Again, to keep people from injuring each other through defrauding them. The butcher who puts his thumb surreptitiously on the scale along with the meat that he's weighing and adds the slight pressure of the weight of his thumb to the weight of the meat he's selling you has injured you by inflating the cost of the goods through a fraudulent practice. And government is necessary to regulate that sort of thing, to come up with just weights, measurements, and standards, and so on. And so government arose in the first place by God in order to protect humanity. But not just humanity, but also the world itself. Remember that when Adam and Eve were placed in this magnificent garden, they were given the mandate by God to dress the garden, to till the garden, to cultivate the garden, not to exploit or to abuse this world. And so you also have the responsibility of governments to regulate how we treat not only human beings, but how we treat animals, how we treat the environment in which we live, and so on. All of these are considerations of the origin of government. Now, what we hear so much about in this day and age is the phrase separation of church and state, a phrase that you will find nowhere in the founding documents of the American Republic. That phrase is not found in the Declaration of Independence, nor is it found in the Constitution or in the Bill of Rights. It was a remark made by Thomas Jefferson, in which he was speaking about the principles that he believed were implied in the documents that ruled the foundation of this country. But it's become now a phrase that is perhaps the only absolute left in American culture, the absolute principle of the separation of church and state. But how it is used in our day and age is radically different from what even Thomas Jefferson meant by it in the 18th century. Now, I'm going to explore more of that concept of separation of church and state in our next lecture, but now I want to continue. Just notice it in passing and saying that part of the problem we have now is that since the state has been instituted and we do have government, we're always left with the question of how do we as Christians relate to that government. Now, a few years ago, I was invited to be the keynote speaker at an inaugural prayer breakfast in Tallahassee, Florida, on the inauguration day of the governor of our state of Florida. And at that breakfast, when I had the opportunity to speak, I addressed not only the group of people who were assembled, but I also addressed my remarks to the governor himself. And I said to him that this service that we were having was not at all unlike an ordination service that we have in the church. And I've preached several ordination services where a man is consecrated to the sacred ministry of the gospel and is set apart for that vocation in the church. And I said to the governor, I said, today is your ordination day. Today is your ordination ceremony. I said, for this reason, that your office, just as the office of pastor in a church, is ordained by God. And it is because of God's authority that there is such a thing as government. And it's because of God's ordination that you are called to minister to God, not as a preacher in a local church, but as an official of the state. But in your office as governor, you are not given autonomous authority. Your authority, and the only authority that you have whatsoever, is an authority delegated to you by the one who possesses all authority ultimately, who is God. And so the ground basis of the authority by which you will rule in your office as government is God. But I challenge you this day to remember every minute of your term that you are accountable to God for how you exercise that office. And don't be seduced by this mythological concept of separation of church and state, which now means in our culture the separation of the state and God. It's one thing to say that the state operates apart from the authority of the church. It's another thing for us to say the state functions or operates apart from the authority of God. That would be sheer paganism and would be a total repudiation of Judeo-Christianity, where we are convinced that the state, as much as the church, is instituted by God, ordained by God, has whatever authority it has through the delegation of divine authority to it, and therefore is answerable and accountable to God. The minute any government, whether it's in the United States, in China, or in Russia, the minute any government declares itself independent from God, it has become demonized at that point and becomes an evil empire. Because it now, as a government, is in rebellion against the authority by which it rules in the first place. And at that point, it is the task of the church to call the government not to be the church, but to call the government to be the government, to be faithful to its institution and its ordination. And those are the remarks I made to the governor of our state at the time. But of course, in this day and age, to speak in these terms is to be a voice of one crying in the wilderness, because in fact, we do live in a society that has been radically secularized and where it's tacitly assumed that the civil government is not answerable to God and in fact has a right to be godless. And it seems that right now the great tragedy of our country is that our government is doing everything in its power to demonstrate that pretended right. We boast as Americans that we live in a free country. And that's true, relatively speaking. But no people in any land have ever lived in an atmosphere of complete freedom. Anywhere there is government, there is restriction to people's liberty. Every law that is ever enacted by any legislative body restricts somebody's freedom. If we enact a law against murder, we're placing restrictions on the criminal's right to kill a person with malice aforethought. We're saying you're not free to do that with impunity. But sometimes we forget, or there are obvious needs for laws of that type, that every law, every single law that is passed, restricts somebody's freedom. Perhaps rightly, perhaps wrongly. But every law that is passed brings to bear upon the citizens of the government who are under that government legal force. Every law that is passed by every legislature now gives a sanction to the use of force, power, and might to force people to conform to that law. That's why we have to be exceedingly careful every single time we pass a law, that we realize what we're doing, that we are taking freedom away from people. And the longer we do that, and the more carelessly we do that, the less liberty we are left with in our lives.
You're listening to Renewing Your Mind, the listener-supported outreach of Ligonier Ministries. Today's message by Dr. R.C. Sproul is titled, Legal Force. There's far more to hear from this classic series than we're able to air this week. There are 6 lessons from Dr. Sproul and a question and answer session with Dr. Sproul and Dr. R.C. Sproul, Jr. You know, church and state is not a new idea. It's been debated for years. And in fact, one of the early church fathers, Augustine, wrote a pivotal work on this very topic. The book is called City of God. It contrasts political experience in the here and now with eternal citizenship in God's kingdom. We're delighted to be able to offer this classic piece of literature to you, along with Dr. Sproul's series, Church and State,
for your financial gift of any amount. So call us at 800-435-4343, or you can make your request and give your donation online at renewingyourmind.org. Dr. Sproul is the founder of Ligonier Ministries, a teaching fellowship dedicated to helping Christians understand what they believe, why they believe it, how to live it, and how to share it. So we encourage you to contact us today with your gift of any amount. We will say thank you by providing a copy of the entire series on CD, along with Augustine's classic book, City of God. Again, our number is 800-435-4343, and our web address is renewingyourmind.org. Well, should Christians submit to ungodly leaders? That's our topic tomorrow, and we hope you'll join us for Dr. Sproul's message, Civil Obedience. That's tomorrow on Renewing Your Mind.